Yankees Files Podcast. We are back. I'm Will Harris, you're Alec Whipple, and the rest of you are fans of a team that doesn't trail anyone except the Orioles and Rays by more than a game and a half in the standings currently. Anyone in baseball, that is. So for all the consternation about the Yankees, they'd be leading like basically every division except the one that they're in or within a game and a half. They're coming off a 6-1 week. I regret to inform all the doomers that this team is actually good. And I wonder if anyone was saying that all along. Whipple, do you remember anyone who was saying that all along? Maybe a group of anyone's?
I mean, I think you could look back at some former tweets and podcasts and see that, you know, maybe on and Yankees Files and wherever we were off in crazy Yankees Files land spouting nonsense about how the season wasn't over. Maybe it wasn't so crazy after all. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this is a team that is 14-6 in May. That's the best record in baseball in that time. They're 11-3 in their last 14, including going on the road and taking 3 out of 4 from the Blue Jays at Rogers Center. And then, you know, dutifully completing a sweep in an 11:30 game on Peacock in Cincinnati without Aaron Judge. The team's just good, man. And let's not bury the lead. Aaron Hicks is no longer on it. I was listening back to some earlier episodes of Yankees Files. I think I listened to the three most recent ones because they chart an interesting arc of how this team has performed from getting embarrassed in Texas. We recorded that episode when they were 15-14. And then they had that 3-3 week. And then they had the 5-2 week and now this 6-1 week. So yeah, it kind of charts an interesting arc, as I was saying. And on one of those episodes, I asked you, over under the trade deadline, will Aaron Hicks take his last plate appearance as a Yankee? And you said over, which I did not agree with. And you asked me, okay, what's the triggering event? Like, what is the thing that happens that makes Aaron Hicks' tenure as a Yankee end? And
you said Greg Allen being traded. And I was like, you know what? Like, this guy is actually a magician.
I unfortunately did not say the Yankees will trade for Greg Allen and exercise or comply with the upward mobility clause in his contract. But I did make reference to them adding an outfielder. This isn't the one I thought it was going to be, but here we are. It's May 22nd, and we're never going to see Aaron Hicks. Well, I guess it's not technically necessarily true that we will never see Aaron Hicks play in a Yankee uniform again, but Aaron Hicks' most recent stint with the Yankees is over.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely the most shocking event of a week in which there were plenty of surprises, especially all the stuff that happened early in the week in Toronto. But to learn, I think when the Yankees traded for Greg Allen, and I put out a tweet that was like, there's like an 85% chance this is Willie Calhoun and like the 15% chance this is the end of Aaron Hicks. It was mostly just like, okay, like Aaron Hicks is a possibility to get DFA'd as he is like almost every time we have been, you know, talking about a roster move. But to actually hear it happen was pretty shocking. And I was in the off season and thought they were going to trade him, and kind of, you know, once the season started, didn't have that same optimism. And I know you were talking about the role that they saw for him, and he actually had been fitting into that role and hitting better and definitely in the last week or so. So it was surprising about the timing, but I think, you know, the Yankees they're not dumb. They're not going to give into small sample optimism. And the fact is, Aaron Hicks did not have, you know, he'd never role on this team roster wise. I think he had worn out his welcome with just like the stuff that we don't have to go through, but we've talked about ample times on this episode or on these episodes. But at the end of the day, I think the Yankees got slightly better by getting rid of Aaron Hicks. But in the long run, I think it was the absolute right move to not have him on this team. Like, Greg Allen definitely is like an Aaron Hicks light with speed, but just to not have Aaron Hicks have to be placed on a lineup every few days. I mean, it was very evident they had little trust in him. And I think it's just for the best for both sides. It's definitely kind of crazy. I know the money isn't crazy, but to give up on a guy with 2.5 years left is not something we've even seen, you know, even with comparable eating money situation, such as A-Rod and Ellsbury. Those guys were in the last year and a half of their deal. So this is definitely shocking. I think definitely the right move for the Yankees in terms of just their commitment to not having somebody on the roster just because he makes money. It's something that we've been asking for a while. And, you know, no disrespect to Aaron Hicks, but this team just, he wasn't a fit on this team. Like, he's had good moments. He's had great moments as a Yankee, probably more great moments than like a lot of really good players with the Yankees have had. So, you know, for 3 or 4 years, like, he was absolutely worth his roster spot. And just with the wrist surgery in 2021 and then last year, definitely not multiple years of poor performance. As you noted, he was hitting pretty well before he kind of fell off a cliff last year. But just in the last 3 years, not really finding his way with the bat, kind of a step down on defense, and then just a lot of moments where he, you know, it was just kind of like made you roll your eyes and kind of shocked at somebody, you know, kind of having those brain lapses on a Major League Baseball field. And this is not, I don't want to distract us from talking about all the great things the Yankees have been doing this week, but it feels like pretty significant, more so just for the shift in like mentality about like how they're going to handle contracts such as Aaron Hicks on this current team. And I think we all kind of have someone else in mind who might get similar treatment, and less so about like getting rid of Aaron Hicks, but it was time. I think it's been time for maybe a year. And I'm glad that this team is showing a commitment to, you know, not playing guys who probably aren't worth the roster spot over guys who are, whether that's Greg Allen or somebody else in the future. It definitely gives more flexibility, probably makes the outfield need a lot more clear, you know, a lot more space open for another guy to come join the team. And I think that's probably their most pressing need, as we discussed last week. But yeah, the Aaron Hicks era is over, and it was definitely an interesting era. Like, as I said, probably had more great moments than he deserved to.
Yeah, Aaron Hicks is funny because there are a number of kind of signature moments that he had, whether it was, you know, the go-ahead home run and diving catch in Minnesota, or the homer off the foul pole off Verlander in the ALCS, or, you know, the three-run home run off Stanek in what, or was it Presley? One of the two. Presley. In what was probably, you know, the best game, the best regular season game, most exciting regular season game the Yankees played last year, or among them. You know, Aaron Hicks kept popping up in those situations. And, you know, you pointed out that I mentioned on Twitter, like, the guy for his first, like, 285 plate appearances or something last year was a good hitter. He had a 112 WRC plus. So the idea that Aaron Hicks has been awful for years, as people were saying, like, that's not really totally true. But, man, when he hit that cliff right after the trade deadline, he never recovered. And, you know, it's disappointing to see for a guy who was as good as Aaron Hicks was in 2018, and when he was healthy in 2017, and for a guy who was a big part of a number of the recent good Yankees teams, for a guy who, you know, delivered the playoff performance that he delivered despite needing Tommy John surgery in 2019. There's a lot that you can say about the way the Aaron Hicks tenure went wrong, and I don't think we need to pile on that, but yeah, the historical reassessment of that situation is just going to, I think, show us how weird it was. So let's get to something else that was weird, which is the entire series that the Yankees played in Toronto. Where do we even start with this? It feels like it was ages ago.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you got to start with the eighth inning of game one.
Okay. I think I agree. So let's, if we can, take our minds back to, gosh, when even was that?
A time when Aaron Hicks
was still on the Yankees. I guess that was, what was it, a week ago? Yeah, it was a week ago tonight.
Yeah,
so
Monday.
We were recording the podcast. We had Ryan on. As we were recording the final segment, I noted that Alek Manoah was starting to give up home runs. He gave up one to Aaron Judge. He gave up another to Willie Calhoun. The Yankees were up 5-0 and later 6-0 and later 7-0. Some of that damage not off Alek Manoah. But as you said, things started to get weird in the top of the eighth inning when Aaron Judge came up against, a pitcher who everyone has found it impossible to hit, which is why he has such an extensive major league track record and definitely didn't get sent down shortly after the game and has, stuck in the major leagues multiple times and, didn't make his major league debut at 31 years old. That's Jay Jackson. And Aaron Judge hit a ball about as far as I've ever seen anyone hit a ball in Rogers Center to give the Yankees a 7-0 lead off Jay Jackson. And then things started to get weird.
Yeah. I mean, after that was the moment when the Blue Jays broadcasters rewound the broadcast and slowed down the Aaron Judge eye movement and picked up something that was pretty imperceptible to pretty much everyone else. But in the moment, everyone, no one really understood what was going on until the Blue Jays called attention to it. And all of a sudden, on everyone's screens, you see Aaron Judge looking over to the first base coach. And in that moment, I don't even think I realized this until I was looking on Twitter. Like, this was imperceptible to somebody just watching the game. But afterwards, I think, was when John Schneider started calling attention to this, and the broadcasters first mentioned it, and then that's okay. But when the manager starts talking about it, that's kind of when it got real, when he started saying that it was funny, they'd have to look into it, we're just kind of questioning where he was looking. And then I feel like that kind of kicked off the fireworks, because that legitimized this, broadcasters talking about something to keep a 7-0 game interesting, into the Blue Jays are accusing Aaron Judge and the Yankees of cheating. And it was crazy. I mean, you would have never have perceived in the moment that anything had happened. And Aaron Judge's answer was, pretty nonchalant. Like, I was looking at the dugout, whatever, obviously kind of a wishy-washy excuse. But I think the crazy part to me is, and I mean, it's so obvious to even say that this was the issue, that obviously he was tipping pitches. He said he was tipping pitches the next day. But the Blue Jays were mad about something that either was A, legal, because you can pick up tip if somebody's tipping pitches, that's part of baseball, you can pick that up, or B, impossible, because if you're alleging that the Yankees had somehow hacked into their pitch comm, that's impossible. There's no scenario here where the Blue Jays were alleging that the Yankees cheated in a way that was completely, on them, not acceptable. And they, I think to make matters worse, they kept talking about it the next day. They called Major League Baseball in to look at it. And of course, Major League Baseball said nothing's going on. It was just such a, for a team that talks an awful lot and doesn't win an awful lot, to go and, I mean, it's true, to go out on that ledge and make an accusation like that in a game that you're getting crushed, and then go out the next day, make the same accusation, double down, have the league clear your player and that, or the other player, and then lose again and still double down. And it was just the Blue Jays have just gotten into so much trouble with that over the last few years. You'd think they would have learned. And this whole week, whether it was against the Yankees or against the Orioles, showed that they're just nowhere near at the maturity level they need to be a championship contender. I get their skill level, but maturity's part of it too, and they don't have it.
People talk about the Yankees always getting destroyed by the guys, these specific guys with whom they take issue, whether it's Jose Altuve, whether it's Carlos Correa, whether it's Vlad Jr., whether it's Randy Arozarena, whether it's Tim Anderson. People give the Yankees a lot of crap about that. And today, or last week in the Blue Jays series, Aaron Judge gave that treatment to another team. So the Blue Jays accuse him of cheating, even beyond their own pitcher admitting to tipping pitches. Judge obviously gave a fake answer. He lied when he was asked, what were you looking at? He said, I was looking in the dugout to see who was chirping the umpire, because Boone had been thrown out earlier in his plate appearance. But like, if you're picking up that a guy is tipping, you're not going to give that away. Because what about if you face him again? Not that I anticipate Jay Jackson making many more major league appearances. But, you know, Judge isn't going to say, yeah, he was tipping. Judge was obviously looking down the first baseline to be told what pitch was coming, which, as you said, was totally fine. What ultimately came out is Jackson was bringing his glove up by his head, at which point the first base coach could see if he, you know, the grip of the pitch, and then he was relaying that to Judge. All totally legal. Kind of makes you wonder if the people who say the Astros knowing what pitch was coming didn't help them, but that's a different issue. And Aaron Judge went yard, because when you, first of all, when you throw Aaron Judge the same pitch six times in a row, you're probably not going to have much success. Second of all, he knew what pitch was coming. Third of all, he is a giant human. The Blue Jays, you know, freaked out about it, implied that the Yankees were cheating. Obviously, the Yankees weren't. It was confirmed by everyone, including the guy who threw the pitch. And what does Judge come out and do the next day after the Yankees blow a 3-0 lead? He hits a go-ahead two-run home run to the same spot that he hit the home run the prior night off Eric Swanson, the reliever who the Blue Jays gave up a King's ransom for, and I'm sure they don't want Teoscar Hernandez's offense in their anemic lineup, to give the Yankees the win in that game. And then, you know, after a relatively unimpressive, kind of deflating 3-0 extra innings loss on... in game three of the series, Judge comes back, hits a two-run homer in the first inning of game four off Berríos. Once a twin, always a twin, to give the Yankees a lead that they would not relinquish in the last game, and they win the series 3-1. One thing we should also cover, Domingo Germán got ejected for having sticky stuff on his hands after the third inning of the second game. The Blue Jays were also mad about that. I think they should be. You know, it still isn't clear, and there still does not appear to be any sort of, you know, provision in the rules for a process for figuring out, hey, if an umpire says a guy's hand is too sticky, are we going to figure out what actually was on the guy's hand, or where he was getting it from, or how it was being applied, or any of that? What are we going to do to make sure this isn't just rosin that we think is too sticky, that's not a banned substance, that he would then just have to wash off? Like, that, I think, is all unclear. None of it exonerates Domingo Germán. He said it was just rosin, but, like, of course he's going to say that. So, like, if I'm a Blue Jays fan, I'm probably pretty mad about that. If I'm a Blue Jays fan, I also have to be mad at Kevin Gausman for giving up a home run to Isaiah Kiner Falefa in that game. So, like, you know, there's a little bit of a give and take there. But, you know, that was just another element of this series that made it super weird. But for what felt like, or I should say, in what felt like a departure from the way people tend to act like this team operates, the Yankees were in like a weird, fiery, contentious situation, and they came out the decisive victors. And maybe Toronto's just not that good, which would be funny for various reasons, but I think we have to be pretty happy with, you know, the way the Yankees handled that series.
Yeah, and they were the ones who came out of it with the wins, but also with their heads held high. I mean, you had John Schneider yelling at Brad Wilkerson, calling him a fat boy. You had Kevin Gausman yep. saying that they wanted those three innings back that Domingo Germán threw, and for all sorts of reasons. Like, both these comments are very problematic. I really don't need to explain why the former is problematic. And the latter one, like, that, to say you want three innings back in a game where, again, you gave up a home run to Isaiah Kiner Falefa and your team lost, like, pretty definitively, I don't really think that asking for, you know, whining about guys who may or may not have been using sticky stuff is the way to go. Like, I think obviously it's not great, and like, we're not supporting Domingo Germán. I agree with you that, you know, what I kind of get annoyed about is that people are, I think this is more of like a, you know, like a cultural or language thing, but people are rightly upset at Domingo Germán. I think those same people should also be upset at Max Scherzer. And just because Max Scherzer yelled and exactly. screamed about it on TV and gave a very convincing press conference after, whereas Domingo Germán probably less command of the English language and just like less familiarity with how to handle himself in these situations, did not really give such a convincing answer. I just want people to view everything the same way as I'm sure you do. So what the way to view it is not Kevin Gausman whining about, you know, wanting multiple scoreless innings back. I think the way to view it is the Yankees won, and also Domingo Germán did a thing that he should not have done and is rightly getting penalized for it.
Also, let's be clear, the Yankees gave the Blue Jays those three innings back when they pitched Ryan Weber and Albert Abreu the seventh and eighth. That's like, those are, I understand that's only six outs, but that's like 18 outs right. that the Yankees gave them in the seventh and eighth innings on, what would that have been, Thursday. And for the Blue Jays to act like they are owed anything after those are the high leverage relievers the Yankees used and they still lost is embarrassing.
Yeah, when our text messages were just like, why is Ryan Weber pitching? Oh God, Ryan Weber's going to give up a home run. Oh no, he did. Oh, he actually got out of this. It was like, I mean, not that we're ever like ready to, you know, write the obituary, but I really was like, you know what? Like maybe this just isn't their game, but you know, good teams find a way to win those games, and the Yankees found a way to win a game where they were pretty short-staffed in the bullpen. I think...
Yeah, I mean, we got a couple innings of high-leverage Abreu in this past week, and he handled himself well. I think, you know, it's possible there were some overreactions to the Taylor Walls Grand Slam, but since that game, Albert Abreu's handled himself nicely.
Mm-hmm, and... as you said, he will either strike someone out or give up a home run hit or give up balls hit to Austria-Hungary. And we saw it with that Matt Chapman at bat, which almost ended that game or put it in serious doubt right there. Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much that went on in this series. I mean, we didn't even talk about the issue with the coaching boxes, which is if the sticky stuff is like a normal cheating controversy and the stealing signs is like, okay, we're really stretching it here. This is a dumb application of like a cheating controversy that may or may not, you know, have existed at other times. This being in the coaches' boxes was just like the most absurd non-controversy probably in Major League history, considering the amount of times that it has been done and the lack of issue that has ever been made of it. And again, the fact that the Blue Jays just decided to harp on this issue really speaks poorly to how they handle themselves. I mean, we rag on the Blue Jays a lot, probably sometimes not justified, but like every single thing,
they deserve it.
Every single thing people said in this series was justified because it's a team that like does not know when to shut up. Everybody is the main character and
has never won anything.
Has never won a playoff game. And we saw again in the Orioles series over the weekend, they start these controversies for no freaking reason. I mean, It feels good to, because the Yankees are clearly better in both the way they handle themselves and the talent on the field. And yeah, I agree with you. If Toronto was bad, it would be really funny for a number of reasons that date back to last year and how this team is like the darlings of preseason projections and routinely is just falling flat on its face. And if they actually did not make the playoffs, I think that would be really funny.
It would be awesome. Dalton Varsho, 74 WRC plus. Meanwhile, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is hitting like Barry Bonds in Arizona.
That's the secondary piece of that trade.
Yeah, there's simply nothing like it. Yeah, and on the coach's box thing, we then got the greatest instance of petty Aaron Boone of all time, where he was yelling at the umpire to make the Blue Jays third base coach get back in the coach's box after the Blue Jays had very publicly complained about it. Like, imagine it. How stupid do you have to be to go, hey, the other team better not do this thing, and then go out there and immediately do that thing you were saying no one should be allowed to do. It kind of makes you think that the Blue Jays were stealing signs and using sticky stuff.
As Talkin' Yanks or Dan O'Rourke said on Twitter, one of the two, that this is like whatever genre of managing or category of managing this is, Aaron Boone just like routinely crushes it.
I think
every time he is in a controversy, he definitely always comes out ahead. It was petty for all the right reasons. Like, it was just stupidity that he was just pointing out how stupid it was. And again, yeah, it was like the dumbest thing. And I agree with you. Maybe the Blue Jays are projecting and doing the things that they complained about. But like, we know what this Blue Jays team is. Like, they scare me less than, honestly, they scare me less than the Orioles at this point, because, like, you know, the Orioles are going to get on the field to play hard. And, you know, the Blue Jays, just for whatever reason, sometimes they will, and then sometimes they'll just start yelling at your dugout for no reason.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. Okay, we can't spend the whole podcast talking about how funny it is that the Blue Jays are bad, but it is really funny. Whipple, I want to talk to you about how the Yankees are good. So they went to Toronto and won three out of four. Then they went to Cincinnati and won the first two games, both times, you know, adding insurance runs at valuable times, because we did see another instance of high leverage Ryan Weber in a game that went to extra innings. It felt a little bit weird that the Yankees were playing an extra inning game with the Reds, but they handled it, and an Anthony Rizzo home run in the 10th made it a lot easier to stomach. It took a lot of the drama out of high leverage Ryan Weber. And, you know, weirdly enough, we got another Isaiah Kiner-Falefa homer in that game, so I don't know what's going on with that. But what I want to talk to you about is the game that they played yesterday, because it was one of my favorite days of the year, a day that I think should be a national holiday, which means we would have to observe it today, which means I probably shouldn't have done so much work today. It was the Luis Severino return. And aside from a very questionable umpire judgment call about where runners should be placed on a fair foul review that allowed a run to score, Sevy was awesome. You know, he unfortunately did not qualify for the win because with two outs in the fifth inning, he was removed from the game after he allowed Tyler Mahle to single. But he looked great. He touched 99. He got a bunch of swings and misses. He struck out five guys in 4 2/3. He allowed four hits, one of which was like a bloop that Jake Bauer should have caught. None of the others did very much damage at all. Like, Luis Severino looked awesome, and I am so excited to have him back. And, you know, someone pointed out on Twitter that, like, this is a team that's playing at a 96 win pace, and they're going to turn Willie Calhoun into Giancarlo Stanton and what else was it? Clark Schmidt into Carlos Rodon and Albert Abreu into Tommy Canley. And I assume Ryan Weber into Jonathan Loaisiga and Domingo Herman into Frankie Montas. Maybe, I don't know if that ends up being good, but like, this is beautiful. And I feel like with every guy that's come back from injury, whether it was Harrison Bader, whether it was Aaron Judge, and now Luis Severino, all of the questions that people raised about if that return from injury was really going to be as impactful as it was built up to be were demonstrated to be stupid. And I thought Luis Severino did a great job of demonstrating that, yeah, having Luis Severino in your rotation is actually a really freaking good thing. And he's got a lot to give to this team.
Yeah, no, and I was lucky enough to go see him in Somerset on Tuesday for his rehab start, and definitely did not look like super sharp. But as he said, it's like, it's rehab. Just, you know, you just got to get through it, be healthy. I mean, for most people, that's pretty standard. For Luis Severino, that is certainly not standard. We have seen a few times that be an issue getting through rehab starts healthy. So I was relieved, like, as soon as he left the game, you know, I just knew he was headed to Cincinnati. I think having him in the rotation is just, it's when, you know, when Domingo Herman is back, you will feel the impact of not having to start Johnny Brito, or if they decide to take Clark Schmidt out of the rotation, just, again, having multiple guys who you can count on to be, you know, give you quality starts every fifth day. Because right now, with some slight hiccups by Nestor, we saw that it's kind of tough when you have a lot of question marks in your rotation at the same time. And the Yankees built the rotation to be ready for October. You know, obviously, like, it's a long season. This is not their October rotation, but we saw it was having an adverse impact on them winning games. And like you said, like, this team is only going to add pieces. And even if, you know, guys have hiccups like Jose Trevino being out for a week with a hamstring strain, you know, the full health Yankees are being closer to being assembled, and having, you know, Luis Severino, who historically, like, has been, you know, the ace of multiple staffs. Like, this is not adding in a guy who they're hoping for to be good. It's a guy who can come in when he's stretched out and have an immediate impact, both in terms of length he can provide and just, like, quality, you know, quality of his starts. Like, he's, I don't know, there's nothing really you can say about Luis Severino that we haven't, like, that is groundbreaking, that we haven't seen. I mean, we know what he, when he's on, you know, with the good fastball, with, you know, just like what he looked like in Cincinnati was a, you know, less stretched out version of the Luis Severino who's going to be a big part of this team. And I'll be interested to see what they actually end up doing. I mean, my guess is now that Johnny Brito is sent down, it's just going to be, you know, he's probably not going to come back up. But I don't know if Clark Schmidt keeps struggling. I know he pitched well in Cincinnati, and hopefully that's, you know, he just continues doing that, because I think their preference is to have Clark Schmidt in the rotation. But it's a lot better talking about the Clark Schmidt versus Johnny Brito potential, you know, pitching battle versus, like, we have four spots we need to fill. Like, how do we fill these? And we've stretched out our depth. And, I mean, there are other guys, you know, they have Will Warren in the minors who could potentially make an impact. Like, this team, it's a lot easier to look at the upside for this team in the pitching department versus saying, like, the season is lost because all of their pitchers are hurt or struggling. And yeah, having, I mean, Gerrit Cole at the top is always good. But, like, the rest of it's kind of falling into place. I think Severino is the biggest part of that puzzle.
I don't even know how much of a concern, like, provided the guys who are healthy stay healthy, I don't even know how worried I am about the rotation from the perspective that, you know, look, Clark Schmidt has not been good. He hasn't been good. But, you know, in three of his last four starts, he's allowed two runs or fewer. In the start against Cleveland, neither of the runs were earned even. And in, what is this, like, four of his last six starts or... Yeah, four of his last six starts, he's allowed three runs or fewer. Like, he had a very bad start in Texas. He had a very bad start against the Rays that culminated with, you know, Abreu coming in and allowing that grand slam. But, like, especially once Seve gets to the point at which he is giving length, you could start to do some interesting things with the Clark spot, right? Like, one, well, once Herman's suspension is over, so they're, I think they're going to do a bullpen game at some point this week to cover the Herman start, and then you'll have a real Schmidt start. But after that, you'll have Seve fully stretched out. You'll have three guys who you really can rely on to give length. You potentially can get some length out of Domingo Herman. I mean, they've let him pitch, what, into the ninth inning at least once this year, and he's pitched, you know, six innings or into the seventh three other times. So, like, you know, if you're getting some good length out of Herman and you're getting a lot of length out of Cole and Severino, and you're getting kind of Nestor average from Nestor, and hopefully, you know, his most recent start in Toronto was an indication of what he's capable of moving forward, where he was much more effective than we had seen in a little while, then I think you can start doing really interesting stuff with the fifth spot. Maybe you can pair Schmidt up with an opener. Maybe you can do, like, a, you know, two innings from Jimmy Cordero, three or four innings from Clark Schmidt. You know, it doesn't just have to be, like, the one inning opener and then bulk guy. You could get creative with it and, you know, string together bullpen games in a variety of ways. And then, you know, maybe handling it that way lets you bring Carlos Rodon back before he's stretched out to 85 pitches, because you're only expecting to get three or four innings out of the starter on that day. Like, I don't know. I think that, like, just as I was saying about Harrison Bader coming back and locking down center field being more impactful than we were giving it credit for, Judge coming back and locking down right field being more impactful than we were giving it credit for, I think Severino being a pillar in the rotation as opposed to a question mark really meaningfully changes the flexibility that they have to handle the rest of the staff. And I think that's how you end up in these situations where you know, you have no choice but to go to high leverage Albert Abreu and Ryan Weber is because the starters that you have aren't offering you that flexibility. And getting to have, you know, two guys every 5 days or three guys every 5 days who you generally expect to go pretty deep into games is so, so different from when Seve was hurt and Nestor was bad and Herman was, you know, the question mark that he is, where you have one guy every 5 days who you're expecting to give you some length. Mm-hmm. And I think the stability that Seve is going to provide is going to be really, really important for this team.
Yeah, and this team has really relied on its bullpen in the first few months. I mean, I think if one part of the team can be said to have been most consistent, it's the bullpen. Like I had noted that five of the top 12 players right now in WAR are relievers, and that's like pretty rare for a team, I think, generally. But Michael King, Ian Hamilton, you know, Clay Holmes kind of having his resurgence now. Wandy's been nails all year. And I just think, like, and Jimmy Cordero, I mean, like, I think the what they've been able to do with, like, a beleaguered rotation and this bullpen basically working overtime to keep them in some of these games and really help them succeed in areas where, you know, this team could have been a lot farther under with the way that offense was hitting back in late April. But, yeah, like you said, now you can get creative. Like, now you can deploy guys, you know, not because out of necessity and get locked into those Albert Abreu, Ryan Weber, high leverage games, but really use them judiciously and be able to put guys in the situations where they best can succeed, which we know will happen because, and this goes back to the conversation that we've been probably having for like 5 or 6 weeks running now, that Boone is willing to use any reliever anytime. He's absolutely deploying Clay Holmes in the right situations, especially as he's gotten better and better. And I think it kind of puts everyone to shame that was complaining about maybe not like every time he's been brought in, but some of the more, you know, recent times of his being brought in and failing. Like if you have a Clay Holmes who is pitching at the peak of his capabilities, then
he's the best pitcher in baseball.
Yeah. Like we've seen it and he should be used to face the team's best righties in almost every game that he can. And we know now that Boone is willing to do that. I think it doesn't, this team is like, I mean, we've said that the Yankees should be more flexible at closer. And I just think the way this bullpen was set up with having no big money guys for the first time in honestly, I mean, decades because of the existence of Mariano Rivera, they've been able to do things with this bullpen and really help these guys carry the team and succeed. And now it's exciting because there's going to be even less pressure on them. And you'd expect that this would help them avoid situations, again, where they have to bring in guys who probably aren't the best fits for that specific role. Or because guys might be hurt or guys might not be available because of being used too many times. I am kind of intrigued by the Albert Abreu renaissance. Like, if that's an actual thing that's happening this week, because watching him pitch on Thursday, I was like, damn, like, I was kind of trashing on him Sunday, but, like, he's really good when he's on. And I know what you had said about it, but he's the drug, yeah.
That's the intoxicating thing about Albert Abreu is you see him come into these games, so his last three appearances, he's faced 11 batters. He hasn't allowed a hit. He's only walked one, and he struck out four guys. So that's a 10.8 strikeouts per nine, a 2.7 walks per nine, a 0 ERA, a 1.79 FIP. Like, Albert Abreu, when he's throwing strikes and getting whiffs, is like a beautiful thing. But when Albert Abreu can't throw strikes and then every strike he throws gets hit to Austria-Hungary or the former Yugoslavia, like that's where you run into the problem. And I don't know. I think it's too early to say if the last, you know, 3 1/3 innings of Albert Abreu are an indication that he's going to, like, that he's turned a corner, that now he's a strike thrower, that now, you know, he can throw that breaking ball out of the zone, like the one he threw to, was it Bichette? Because, you know, he can reliably pound the inside of the zone. Like, that would be great. That's what the Yankees have seen in him this entire time. That's what they've been waiting for him to become. It hasn't happened yet. I don't think definitively, but we've seen a flash of what Albert Abreu could be. And even if Albert Abreu can just be that until Tommy Canley comes back, and then Tommy Canley can just be that until Jonathan Loaisiga comes back, or until the Jimmy Cordero magic runs out or whatever it is, like, that would be so valuable for this bullpen.
Yeah, and this bullpen will find the next guy, and they'll bring him up, whether that's Will Warren as a reliever, or, you know, they were signing Michael Feliz off the scrap heap. I'm sure he'll be pitching some valuable innings. Like, again, I just kind of trust what they're doing.
You and I both know it's super high leverage Davey Garcia.
That, honestly, like, maybe they bring him to do the you know, be part of the bullpen game this week.
Yeah, I could definitely see that happening.
Davey Garcia being a thing, like a lowercase t thing, is like more of a possibility than I'd ever thought 3 months ago. And if Davey Garcia is a lowercase t thing, that opens the door for Davey Garcia to be an uppercase t thing. That's my baseball analysis.
That would be awesome. All I want is for Davey Garcia to be an uppercase T thing. Do you know how back I would be if Davey Garcia was an uppercase T thing? I mean, for the Yankees to go 6-1 in the week when Clint Frazier and Gary Sanchez both make their returns to Major League Baseball, like, the last thing I need when I'm riding this high, I would be insufferable if Davey Garcia were to come back and just start getting outs at the major league level. I would be such a problem with how good, you know, with how well Gleyber Torres is playing too. He had a 104 mile an hour oppo homer the other day. Like, people don't want that. At least people who don't want me to be happy don't want that. And that's a lot of people on Twitter.
It only took the sacrifice of one Miguel Andujar to make this all happen.
It did. And you know what? As much as I love you, Papi Andujar, this was necessary. So, Whipple, I mentioned the standings earlier. The Yankees have a series coming up with the Orioles at Yankee Stadium. And the Orioles are one of just two teams in Major League Baseball that the Yankees trail in the standings by more than a game and a half, ironically enough. Both those teams are in the Yankees division. It's the Orioles and the Rays. Yankees are going to play six games this week, three against the Orioles and then three against the Padres. The Padres, who, if you're disappointed with the Yankees, oh my gosh, you'd be disappointed with the Padres. Holy cow. That's a different story. Are the Padres the Blue Jays of the NL West? Maybe. The Yankees have a chance to move into second place with a good series against the Orioles. And I think, you know, there are reasons to believe the Orioles are really good. There are reasons to believe that the Orioles are, you know, have managed to play to this point as something greater than the sum of their parts, and that their run prevention isn't really as reliable as it has looked, and that there's, you know, some regression coming. But with the fact that the Yankees, who were in last place and 10 games back, basically like 2 weeks ago, could move into second place and, you know, I don't know, 3.5, 4.5 games back, whatever it might be, depending on, you know, how much the Jays contribute in this series in Tampa, on like May 25th. That's insane. And I don't want to take a victory lap yet, but I do want you to know that if you were listening to this podcast and you tweeted at us and you said that the season is over, or this is a 500 team, or they can't turn it around, or this team is going to be 20 games back by July 1st, or this team has been the same team since 2020, they're just 500 except for the first half of last year, or playing the kids is important because it's a lost season, so you better get them some experience, or the Yankees are going to end the season in last, or the championship window is closed, I have your tweets, and I will be revisiting them at the appropriate time. I need people to know that.
Yeah, I think people need to understand that. And this honestly kind of reminds me of when we were talking about the Yankees and Astros ALCS, and how you were making the point that, like, everybody saying that the Yankees cannot get past the Astros in ALCS ignore the fact that there's not a whole lot of continuity between 2017 and 2022. Like, there's just a lot of turnover, different guys. That's what people, that kind of same concept, I think people need to understand that, like, the 2021 Yankees were not the same as the 2022 and 2023 Yankees. Like, the team has fundamentally gotten different, improved in a lot of different ways. And again, like, when things don't go well, it doesn't have to be an indictment of the last 5 years of Yankees baseball. It just can be an early season slump in which you're missing the reigning MVP and best hitter in the world. And to have an overreaction that this season is over is just, it's insanity. And then to, we were talking about before the pod, but to make the comparisons to former Yankees teams, I mean, the 96 team, you know, the 98 team, 2000, how they're never going to be as good. 2009, how this team can't ever be as good as that team, even though that team started off 13-15 and was clearly in second place until midway through the season, which they turned it around significantly, made up a lot of ground against the Red Sox. Okay, this team doesn't have Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera, but that team didn't have Aaron Judge and Gerrit Cole. Like, there have been many Hall of Famers in Yankees world champion teams, and I almost guarantee you there are multiple Hall of Famers on the field every day you watch the Yankees. Like, I would bet money on that, and then I will pay you when you can pay me when the last one gets inducted into the Hall of Fame, because that's like, these teams are good, and you don't realize in the moment that, okay, these guys, like, it's going to be okay, it's going to work out. Just as it didn't, nobody realized in the moment it was going to be that way for the 2009 Yankees, for the 1996 Yankees, who had struggled for the last 15 years, who hadn't really won a playoff series since the 80s. 2009, like, that team had a lot to prove, and it was not a guarantee they were going to be as good as they were. So taking that same mindset every single year you watch the Yankees, yes, last year's team did not perform as well as they should have in the American League Championship Series. It was a 99-win team that returned its core, improved by adding Carlos Rodon and Anthony Volpe. And although Rodon hasn't pitched, he will pitch. And Volpe has already made an impact. Like, there are significant improvements still to come, and this team is already showing its capabilities. So hold off on the doom and gloom takes. Perhaps never share the doom and gloom takes, because as long as you're watching the Yankees, they're going to be a good team. And it's pretty safe to say that in a sport where you really can't take much for granted, you can pretty much take the Yankees being a good team for granted. And you feel free to share some of these tweets that you had found, where it was the one tweet where the guy had compared the Yankees to pretty much like 20 or 21 other teams in the last 20 years. And the fact that the Yankees had as many like non-playoff seasons as those teams had winning seasons. I mean, just open your eyes and realize that you're watching a very good team, and the season is far from over. And the only person that the only person that you're making happy is yourself. Like, nobody else thinks it's, you know, funny to watch that you share all these doom and gloom takes, because you're going to get exposed in 2 months or whenever the Yankees have their 30-10 stretch that comes every year.
There's always a 30-10 stretch. That's what you can bank on. So the 2009 Yankees, it's May 22nd. The 2009 Yankees had a 571 winning percentage on May 22nd after a 7-3 loss to the Phillies. 7-3, the score they would eventually win Game 6 of the World Series by to clinch their 27th World Championship. The 2023 Yankees have a 592 or something winning percentage right now. Like, what are we doing here? This is what I want to know. When the 1996 Yankees played their last 60 games at 30-30, and it is a 592 winning percentage for the 2023 Yankees right now, so they would be ahead of the pace of the 2009 team, which was the best team in baseball and won the World Series. Let's get that out there. So I asked this on April 30th, when the 1996 Yankees finished the season 30-30, who was confident that they were going to win the World Series? When the 2000 Yankees started the season 20-9 and then played their last 132 games at 67-65, who thought they were going to win the World Series? When the 2009 Yankees got embarrassed by scores of 10-2 and 22-4 by a Cleveland team that would go on to win fewer than 70 games and started the season 15-17, who was confident that they were going to win the World Series? I mean, the 2009 stuff really is ridiculous. Like, Derek Jeter had the best season by a shortstop his age since integration. Robinson Cano, who had been worth 0.1 Fangraphs WAR in 2008, was worth 3.7 in 2009. That's 37 times better in like 40 more plate appearances. Mark Teixeira didn't hit until May. A-Rod wasn't back until late April. CeCe and Burnett didn't pitch well until May. But when I posed that question on Twitter, the answer I got was, let's be realistic. The teams were different in 1996 and 2009. And I responded that, yeah, one way those teams were different is that they played longer stretches of worse baseball than this team has. Like, that's really all we have right now, is that those teams were worse for longer. Like, arguably, there were fewer reasons to be confident about how those teams would do, particularly the 1996 team, which was relying on the contribution of a number of kids and hadn't won anything in forever, than there are about this team. And it's right. It's completely ridiculous the way that people talk about this. It is, this is my narrative, and now all the facts have to fit into it. So if my narrative is Brian Cashman needs to be fired, Aaron Boone is incompetent, this team is actually, you know, is actually bad, then the facts that fit into that are, well, they started off 15-15. Well, they got swept in the ALCS. Well, you know, Nestor Cortez had this bad start. Well, I'm going to say that they're all injury prone or something because Aaron Judge hurt his hip sliding into third base. Like, I'm going to do all that. And then what I'm going to come out with is this team can't possibly succeed. Well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
I'm not hiding the fact that I think this is a good team. I haven't hidden the fact that I think this is a good team. But in order for you to have been convinced by the first 30 games of this season that the team is actually bad, you would have to believe so many ridiculous things. And I just don't know how people convince themselves to believe those things. Like that, you know, Gleyber Torres, Anthony Rizzo, and DJ LeMahieu would never hit at the same time. Like, Judge coming back wasn't going to help the team. Like, Bader coming back wasn't going to help the team. Like, Severino coming back wasn't going to help the team. Like, you just have to, you can't look at this roster and go, that team's not going to win, like, I don't know, 94 games. Like, it's just, it's an unbelievable thing to convince yourself of, barring extraordinary circumstances. And even in the face of pretty extraordinary circumstances, for the first month of the season, they kept their heads above water. And what have they done in May? They've been the best team in baseball.
Yeah, going back to the 2009 versus, you know, recent Yankees comparisons, the best WRC plus on the 2009 Yankees, well, actually, the best WRC plus was Juan Miranda, but he only played 8 games. Shout out Juan Miranda.
That's
but
right.
Best WRC plus was Mark Teixeira at 142. The best WRC plus on the Yankees in 2022 had a WRC plus that was over 60 points higher than that in 207.
Yep.
So you're telling me, and I get, you know, the lineup was deeper and the 2022 Yankees lineup wasn't as deep. Okay, sure, fine. But you're telling me that going into the 2009 playoffs, not one person said an aging Hideki Matsui, Johnny Damon, Alex Rodriguez, who had been struggling so mightily for years in the playoffs to that point. Nick Swisher, who had never hit well in the playoffs. Robinson Cano, still an unproven commodity. You're telling me nobody had any questions about this team versus last year when, you know, it was obvious that that team wasn't going to perform and hit well with the reigning or the soon-to-be MVP.
They had like 2.5 pitchers.
And they, right, they, we're not even talking about the pitching.
CeCe Sabathia, right. AJ Burnett, who's a coin flip, and then 58-year-old Andy Pettitte.
Right. I'm not even going to talk about the pitchers because, like, that would just get embarrassing in terms of the, you know, the
it
coping
would.
That people
it
do.
Would.
But, like, just looking at the offense, like, there are questions with pretty much every playoff team, and there were questions with that team. There were questions with the best players on that team, and the fact that they won was guys stepped up and hit in October, and those guys were talented, and they were capable of doing that, and they did that. And the Yankees have those same kind of people. They have people who have worlds more potential than the 2009 Yankees. I mean, the 2009 Yankees, didn't have anyone who could dream about doing what Aaron Judge is doing. I mean, that's A-Rod at his peak, not A-Rod on one hip. So let's, like, everybody just needs to remember that, like you said, these teams had tons of question marks, even the ones that, you know, going into 2009 playoffs, like that team, you reasonably could say, you know, they best team in baseball, this team should win the World Series. There were still so many question marks. There were moments in those playoffs where those question marks popped up. Nothing about this is ever going to be easy. And to write, you know, if you wrote that team off, you would have been wrong. But to say that that team shouldn't have been written off and this team should be is just, that's not looking at what the teams actually were.
Yeah. And that's the key. If you look back at the situation that the 2009 Yankees were coming from at this time in the year, people talk about the last 5-6 seasons of postseason failure for the Yankees. The Yankees hadn't won a playoff series since the 2004 ALDS going into 2009. They spent a ton of money in the offseason, and then none of the guys they spent money on were good in the first 30, 40 games. And the team looked bad. They were flirting with 500 that entire time. The idea that people somehow knew at that time that aging Derek Jeter and aging Andy Pettit and one-hip A-Rod and Teixeira, who knows if he could handle New York, and CeCe, who knows if he could handle New York, were eventually going to be great that year is insane. And, like, that's you can't look back at that team and go, oh, well, they started 15-17, but they won the World Series, and then go, that invalidates the comparison to this team. It's May. Like, we don't know what this team is going to become, but the idea that this team's start invalidated it when that team's start didn't invalidate that team. I mean, remember all the plate appearances that were going to Cody Ransom? That's hardly different than the plate appearances going to, like, Oswaldo Cabrera, and at least he has potential. Sorry, Cody Ransom. That was right. A stray. But, like, it's ridiculous.
There's no prospect on the... Yeah, there's no, like, significant young talent on that Yankees team. I mean, Robinson Cano was the closest thing.
And it was his fifth year.
I'm not trying. Yeah, I really don't want to knock the 2009.
No, they
Yankees.
Were amazing.
Obviously, they're a very
they were
special
a phenomenal team.
Team.
They had a number of Hall of Famers. They had the best shortstop, one of the best shortstops, and the best relief pitcher of all time. They had, you know, two starting pitchers who should absolutely be in the Hall of Fame. They had the, you know, best guy at his position at first base. They had, you know, one of the greatest players of all time in Alex Rodriguez. You can't take any of that away from them. But what you can say is they didn't play like that for the first, you know, month and a half of the season. And writing them off would have been stupid in the same way that writing this team off would be stupid. And shame on the people who did. And we'll see how this goes. But if you're the guy who just the other day on May 19th told me you don't think this is much better than a 500 team, I think you ought to reevaluate that.
Yeah, I think that's the takeaway, is like, this team can be that good. Like, obviously they have not been that good specifically at this point, but like, neither were the 2009
But they've been
Yankees.
Better than that team was at this point. Exactly.
Yeah, who was really good last year's Yankees? Like, that we saw how that ended up. It doesn't mean anything. Like, last year's Yankees, 2009, this year's Yankees have the potential to be a championship caliber team. And 2021 Yankees just did not have that potential. So saying this dates back years and years is ignoring that these are fundamentally different teams right now. Like, this, we have been honest, and if you listen to our pods in 2021, like, there were moments where we said, like, this team should probably sell. I mean, like, and we never, I don't think I would say that if this team was, like, you know, went on, like, a 5-game losing streak, was at, like, 500. Like, it's just, it's a different team, and you need to treat them differently and understand that they're capable of doing really, really special things.
Yeah, there's a difference between starting the season 15-15 and starting the season 41-41. I think that's clear. Whipple, we're going to wrap up here. Let's get to confidence. This team has been the best team in baseball in May. They're about to host, the second place team in the division, a team that is exceeding a lot of people's expectations in the Orioles, a team that seems to get every clutch hit and somehow pass a lead to Cano and Felix Bautista every night. It's honestly really impressive what the Orioles have been doing. As the Yankees go into this upcoming series where they'll host Baltimore for 3 games, what is your level of confidence?
I mean, I'm going up to a 9. Like, I think last week against the Blue Jays, like, as you said, they dutifully swept the Reds. I really like that phrasing. Like, it had to be done. Took a little more, you know, anxiety on Saturday than we would have liked, but I think the Blue Jays series, like, maybe the Blue Jays are bad, but as far as we know right now, they are not bad. And the Yankees if they had scored one run in the first nine innings on Wednesday, they would have swept them in four games on the road, which is a really hard thing to do. Like, four-game series on the road are tough. To win one is really hard. To sweep one is probably the hardest thing you can do in baseball. And the Yankees came one run away from doing that. So given that they have been on an upward trend for a few weeks, given that they have added Luis Severino, that they have a fully healthy complement of players, minus Giancarlo Stanton, who is probably 2 weeks away from returning, and given that Aaron Judge is potentially on pace to do something better than he did last year, I mean, if you look at his expected stats this year, he actually is underperformed. Like, last year he overperformed his expected stats. This year he's underperforming his expected stats, which are better than last year. So, like, I don't think it's
scary.
Possible.
That the fact that Aaron Judge just had the best non-Bond season since integration, or, like, you know, the best non-Bond season in the last 55 years or whatever, and is following it up with a season that could be better, at least on a rate basis, is 100% crazy. Right.
Like, I don't know if he can replicate it. I think that's unfair to even, like, think about that. But, like,
it is.
It. But, like, having said that, like, it could happen. And
it could.
As long as Aaron Judge is on this team, I think the Yankees, anyone else would be hard-pressed to make an upgrade that compares with that. I think pretty much every trade last year I kind of summarized by, like, the Yankees still have Aaron Judge and your team doesn't. And that's how I feel right now. Like, this team is on the upward trend, and I think they will continue. So I think it's very reasonable to go to a 9.
Yeah, I mean, a baseball player isn't going to have a, you know, singular impact in the way that, you know, like a basketball player, for example, does. But you could totally see Aaron Judge just having his Kemba Walker moment all postseason and leading this team to a World Series. And it's going to be a lot of fun watching the season that he has. You know, God willing, he stays healthy. It's incredible the kinds of things that he will do. I was in an exchange on Twitter the other day with someone, and they said, you know, like, it's crazy that a guy this big is doing this. Like, what do you attribute it to? And I think, you know, there's a lot that's impressive about Aaron Judge. I think the stature is impressive. The natural talent is impressive. The fact that he moves the way he does for being so big is impressive. But honestly, like, I think the key is really simple, which is he has such good command of the strike zone. Like, Aaron Judge very rarely gets himself out by chasing. And when you have such good command of the strike zone and elite, like, barrel to ball talent in the strike zone, and you're that big, like, only good things can happen. And I think that, you know, you see that when Stanton is on, and you see it with Judge all the time, and that's really cool. With that said, I'm going to go up to a 9 as well. You know, it's a little bit just the Luis Severino effect, where every time I see Luis Severino pitch well, the vibes are off the charts. But it's also just, it feels like things are coming together in a good way for the Yankees. We're free of the Aaron Hicks discourse. We have, you know, another starter that is going to be super effective and reliable. We're seeing, you know, Aaron Judge go on a tear in this last, you know, week, or really the entire time since he's come off the IL. You know, you can see the path to Stanton coming back and contributing. You can see the path to Tommy Cainley coming back and shoring up the bullpen. And it's just an exciting time to be a fan. I feel like the team that I was excited about coming into spring training is coming together in, you know, in a good way, and you just love to see it. So I got to be at a 9 as well. Whipple, any parting shots before we wrap up here?
Yeah, I got two parting shots today. First one is that Anthony Volpe has 4.3 base run, is at 4.3 on Fangraphs base running stats so far, and two players in the 2009 Yankees hit that for a full season. Only one who actually played significant time in the postseason, Johnny Damon. So Anthony Volpe, again, could add another element that we didn't see from that 2009 team. So before, again, not to harp on this point, but, like, Anthony Volpe, Aaron Judge, good players, really good players, potentially game changers in a way that probably your favorite Yankees team did not have. And throwing it back more, my other parting shot is, you know, we discuss a lot kind of your aesthetic, your Gary Sanchez, Clint Frazier. You know, it's been a big week for you. I'm really happy for you.
It's been
personally.
A very big week for me.
but this Tuesday, tomorrow, it's actually a big week, a big throwback for me, because my aesthetic is Gerrit Cole and the 2012 Yankees. And I think you could say this is non-postseason, the biggest Yankees Orioles season at Yankee Stadium, probably maybe since the 2012 era, 2013. And Gerrit Cole will be pitching, and I will be in attendance tomorrow. So I feel like the last time I was at Yankees Orioles was September 2012, when like Chris Davis and Nick Markakis and Orioles Manny Machado were playing. So hopefully maybe this is, you know, it's all cyclical, and in 11 years I'll be talking about the 2023 Yankees in the same way. But, you know, at least I got to, you know, shout out myself for what my personal aesthetic is, and it is pure Gerrit Cole pitching against the Orioles in a competitive game. I feel like the moment was made for me here.
It really was, and I'm very excited for you. I hope you have a great time at that game. Whipple, people can follow us on Twitter, where we're at Yankees Files. They can keep up with the blog, which is at yankeesfiles.com. I'm hoping to get some content up there shortly. They can get the podcast wherever they get their podcast. That's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere else. We hope that if you're enjoying the podcast, you'll rate, review, and subscribe. If you download it and just kind of like let it play a million times, we don't mind that either. If you don't like the podcast, we hope you'll just subscribe, download, listen to it, but not rate it or review it, because, you know, we're trying to bias that sample. I'm active on TikTok, where we're at Yankees Files Podcast, and we do this every week. So we'll be back same time, same place next week to recap the 6 games that the Yankees played against the Orioles and Padres, and everything that has changed, fingers crossed, in a positive way about the AL East standings. Until then, let's go Yankees.